Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Josh Rubner, adjunct lecturer of Justice and Peace Studies at Georgetown University, who discusses the continuing humanitarian disaster in Gaza and the deeply flawed second phase of the ceasefire plan. Kevin Gostola, publisher of the Dissenter newsletter, who talks about the Trump regime's attack on press freedom, seen in the FBI's recent raid on a Washington Post reporter's home and seizure of her computer and phones. And David Daley, senior fellow with the group Fair Vote, who examines Donald Trump's schemes to rig the 2026 midterm election to prevent Democrats from winning control of Congress and a possible third impeachment. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A month after the January 3rd U.S. military attack on Venezuela and the abduction of President Nicolas Maduro, Latin America remains on edge with 15,000 troops in the region and fears that Trump will deploy a permanent U.S. military presence to threaten any government not compliant with Washington's policies. The shifting justifications that the Trump administration cited for its actions against Venezuela have ranged from a focus on confronting narco-terrorism to supporting democracy, all of which was clearly a smokescreen for the real motive controlling Venezuela's vast oil wealth. Since the kidnapping of Maduro, Trump has threatened military action against Colombia, Mexico, and Cuba. Leaders across the region are reassessing their vulnerabilities to a U.S. attack and moving to diversify their sources of military armaments with a goal of achieving technological independence. California Democratic Senator Adam Schiff told Foreign Policy magazine that Trump appears drunk with power since he launched the attack on Venezuela and seems emboldened to use the military in far-flung places from Nigeria and Iran to closer to home in Mexico, Colombia, or even Greenland. The U.S. is leading a major surge in the construction of natural gas plants to power new data centers in service to the expansion and future development of artificial intelligence technology. Global capacity of new gas-fired power plants is expected to increase by 50% in coming years. All of this new gas energy is set to emerge at a significant cost to the climate. Scientists warn that fossil fuels must be rapidly phased out to prevent a major increase in greenhouse gas emissions that will intensify the global climate crisis, such as rising temperatures, extreme weather events, wildfires, droughts, and floods. It's estimated that when built, the gas plants to run data centers in the U.S. will create an estimated 12.1 trillion tons of carbon dioxide emissions. Globally, the surge in emissions from gas plants powering data centers would generate 53.2 billion tons of new carbon emissions. It's predicted that the gas plant construction boom could also lead to much higher electric rates for U.S. consumers. The grassroots protest movement against ICE violence across the U.S. is now targeting corporate enablers of Trump's mass deportation campaign. In late January, New York City police arrested 60 activists in Lower Manhattan who were conducting a nonviolent sit-in protest in the Hilton Garden Inn lobby in opposition to the hotel chain's support for ICE agents and their mass deportation mission. While it remains unclear whether federal immigration authorities were in fact staying at the hotel, Hilton has doubled down on its decision to continue accommodating ICE agents. Earlier in January, Hilton and a locally operated hotel in Minnesota apologized for refusing to serve immigration agents. The company also fired an employee at the Hilton Hotel in Dallas, Texas, who declined to take down a social media video alerting viewers that immigration agents were staying at the hotel. Activists across the U.S. have been organizing No Sleep for ICE actions to make immigration agents stay at hotels uncomfortable by banging pots and pans and blowing whistles outside hotel buildings throughout the night. And some protesters are now calling for boycotts of hotels that accommodate ICE agents in an attempt to inflict some economic pain on the hotels that welcome them. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
On January 26th, the Israel Defense Force recovered the remains of Master Sergeant Ron Gavili, identified as the last remaining deceased Israeli hostage held in Gaza. The body was recovered during an Israeli military operation in a northern Gaza cemetery that disturbed the burial sites of hundreds of Palestinians. The recovery of Sergeant Gavili's body triggered the second phase of President Donald Trump's so-called peace plan, which could begin the enormous task of clearing tons of rubble and reconstruction. More than 2 million Palestinians in Gaza remain at high risk from lack of food, potable water, shelter, and medical care. Since the Gaza ceasefire was declared on October 10th last year, the Israeli military has killed more than 500 Palestinians. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Josh Rubner, Policy Director with the Institute for Middle East Understanding Policy Project and an adjunct lecturer in Georgetown University's program on justice and peace. Here he talks about the continuing humanitarian disaster in Gaza and implementation of the deeply flawed second phase of the ceasefire plan.
Well, Israel has continued to attack and kill Palestinians in Gaza, despite the fact that in this October agreement that was brokered by Trump, it was supposed to have put an end to all Israeli aerial and artillery bombardments. But nearly 600 Palestinians have been killed by Israel since October. The conditions of genocide are ongoing, not only because of these killings, but also because Israel continues to block the provision of humanitarian aid that's needed. Palestinians are still dying because they have inadequate shelter. Their shelter is being blown away in strong winter storms, and children are dying from hypothermia. Israel still blocking the importation of the type of sturdy and durable temporary shelters that would be needed to house Palestinians in better conditions. So it's still extremely grave situation for Palestinians in Gaza, especially as the Trump administration moves on to the so-called second phase of its plan for Gaza, which really involves a Trump-led corporate-style takeover of Gaza, where the Gaza Strip will be redeveloped for the benefit of Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, other family members, and political donors and allies of Trump, basically to make money off of Palestinians' misery, and have Gaza be rebuilt not for the benefit of the survivors of Israel's genocide, but for the benefit of real estate developers who want to cash in on Palestinian misery.
So has any progress been made in clearing all the rubble?
Well, for the most part, Israel has not been allowing in the importation of the type of heavy machinery that would be needed both to clear the rubble and to allow for a search for the thousands of Palestinians who are believed to be dead underneath the rubble. So it's really a situation where we're expecting to see the confirmed fatality figure of now about 72,000 people go up dramatically because, you know, there are untold thousands of people under the rubble still. So no, there's been no reconstruction, so to speak of. There's been some pilot projects that have been tossed around whereby Palestinians might be confined to these ghettos under Israeli military control, where their access to these ghetto housing complexes that Israel is going to construct will be controlled by biometric data. So extremely Orwellian dystopian type of control that Israel and Trump, through his corporate board takeover of Gaza, are going to attempt to implement for Palestinian survivors of genocide. It's really a toxic mix of this neocolonialism of the Trump administration, along with the disaster capitalism that he and his political allies stand to make money from.
And Josh Rubner, what about the food situation in Gaza right now?
The food situation remains dire for a number of reasons. One, because Israel is not abiding by the Trump brokered agreement to allow in 600 trucks per day of humanitarian goods. And oftentimes, what Israel is letting in is very non-nutritious processed foods. So the availability of things like fresh fruits and vegetables appears to be still very limited. And another reason why there are issues in terms of getting food to Palestinians is because Israel is trying to block both UNRWA, the major UN humanitarian agency that's responsible for providing for the social services of Palestinian refugees, from providing these types of services. And also because Israel's deregistered more than three dozen international NGOs that have provided humanitarian assistance to Palestinians in Gaza.
The phase two of Trump's plan was to include the disarmament of Hamas, although I don't believe they ever agreed to that.
This is part of the Trump plan, and the Trump administration's interpretation of it is that they got Hamas's consent to disarm. But Hamas disputes that they ever gave their consent to disarmament and decommissioning of their weapons. What they have said is that they would be willing to give their weapons to some kind of an authority that would eventually become a Palestinian state. It's going to be very hard to stop the Trump administration, to be honest, because they got authorization from the United Nations to implement this plan, which was a really despicable abandonment of the responsibilities of the United Nations, because they basically subcontracted out the running of Gaza to Trump and this corporate style board, giving him almost unlimited powers.
That was Josh Rubner, Policy Director with the Institute for Middle East Understanding Policy Project and an adjunct lecturer in Georgetown University's Program on Justice and Peace. Find more analysis and commentary on the current situation in Gaza by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On January 14th, FBI agents raided the home of Washington Post reporter Hannah Nathanson, seizing her computers, phones, hard drives, and other electronic devices in violation of the Privacy Act that threatens press freedom. The search warrant indicated the raid was initiated by a Trump Justice Department Espionage Act investigation into one of Nathanson's alleged news sources, Pentagon contractor Aurelio Perez Lagones. FBI Special Agent Matthew Johnson, who applied for the search warrant of Nathanson herself, her home, and car, revealed that in the days before the raid, FBI agents had conducted physical surveillance of Nathanson as she entered and exited her home. The government justified its surveillance in a raid on a journalist by stating that their goal was to recover classified information that's evidence of the Pentagon contractor's crimes, which, if disclosed, could harm national security. The raid was a warning about the Trump regime's willingness to violate the First Amendment, as was seen in the Justice Department's January 31st arrest of former CNN anchor Don Lemon and journalist Georgia Fort for reporting on an anti-ICE protest at a Minnesota church. Your reporter spoke with Kevin Gostola, publisher of the Dissenter newsletter, who talks about the FBI raid, titled FBI Spied on Washington Post Reporter Prior to Raiding Their Home.
So extraordinarily, and I think probably the most significant attack on freedom of the press over the last year plus of Donald Trump's second term was this FBI raid on January 14th of Hannah Nathanson's home. And it is so significant because of the fact that rather than seek a subpoena of the reporter, as they could have done, to get information and argue to a court that this material should be handed over for an Espionage Act prosecution, they simply showed up to her house with a warrant. And they took her electronics. They took a laptop that was her personal laptop. They took a work laptop belonging to the Washington Post. They took a Garmin watch, which I can't figure out what they really need for that, but it's a running watch. And they took a voice recorder as well as her iPhone. And they are clear in their search warrant application that they really wanted to get to her Signal messages. And this is where it becomes evident that I think there's a lot of proof that they were going after her communications with sources. She had written in the Washington Post about how she had amassed over 1,000 media sources within the federal government. She was a reporter who had been telling stories about the significant pressures, the different abuses and things that were being witnessed inside of government. Was, you know, just articulating this broad picture of some of what was going on across agencies. And we know, generally speaking, anyone is aware that there's been a lot of issues from when they first had Elon Musk in charge of the different agencies and firing people. And then also we've seen how difficult it is for people who are employees to actually speak their minds without fear of being fired, things of that nature. And so she had been talking to those people, and Aurelio Perez Lagunas is the Pentagon contractor who was indicted under the Espionage Act. And he allegedly was a source of Hannah Nathanson and was someone who provided some documents specifically related to the plotting that was going on within the Trump administration against Venezuela President Nicolas Maduro. At least that's the allegation from the FBI and the Justice Department.
What is the concern now that the FBI, the Trump administration, now has confiscated all her electronic devices? Some of them may be encrypted, but that kind of encryption could be cracked. Could this set a precedent? Could this set a precedent where journalists at any time of the day or night could have their electronic devices, all their personal and private information related to their journalism, be confiscated with the intention of revealing and prosecuting sources?
Yeah, I think absolutely. The reason they got the search warrant was not because they wanted to prosecute Hannah Nathanson for violating the Espionage Act, but just because they said her electronics have classified information that leaked, and they believe that there's some kind of journalist responsibility to return that information to the Pentagon or any other national security agency that handles classified information, which is not the way that things had been balanced, although I'm not saying there was balance, but it was always accepted that if the material was passed along by a source, the government couldn't come into the newsroom and take it and say that you can't access it and use it for news reporting. So it is rather dramatic here how far they are going to crack down. And Hannah Nathanson has made it clear that she's lost access to all of her sources that she was communicating with on Signal because she lost those devices in which she installed the app. When she reinstalls the app, she can't get to her contacts. She can't get to any of those different threads where she was talking to those sources. So it's hard for her to rebuild those connections with the people who were providing stories. And at this moment, she has not authored or worked on any stories for the Post since she was targeted.
That was Kevin Gostola, publisher of the Dissenter newsletter and author of the book titled Guilty of Journalism, The Political Case Against Julian Assange. Find a link to his article, FBI Spied on Washington Post Reporter Prior to Raiding Their Home, and related analysis on the threat to press freedom by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Since his return to the White House last year, Donald Trump has been openly fearful that his unpopular, violent, authoritarian agenda, combined with rising inflation and massive cuts to social safety net programs, will set the stage for Democrats to take back control of the House and maybe the Senate in the 2026 midterm election. Concern that Democratic congressional control could result in his third impeachment. In July, Trump ordered Texas Governor Greg Abbott to launch an unprecedented mid-decade gerrymandering of his state's legislative maps with the goal of giving Republicans an additional 5 House seats, while North Carolina, Missouri, and Ohio also adopted Trump's scheme. California voters approved their own plan to counter Texas by redistricting congressional maps that will likely give Democrats 5 more seats there. More red and blue states may follow suit. Meanwhile, the U.S. Supreme Court appears poised to eliminate Section 2 of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. If conservative justices issue that ruling in the next 2 months, Republican-controlled southern states would be able to redraw district maps of 12 to 19 House seats now held by Democrats in majority-minority districts, giving a big advantage to Republican candidates. Your reporter spoke with David Daley, senior fellow at the group Fair Vote, who examines Trump's recent call for congressional Republicans to nationalize the midterm election and pass the SAVE Act, voter suppression legislation that would disenfranchise tens of millions of Americans, as former Trump advisor Steve Bannon called on ICE agents to surround polling places this November.
Trump can't do this. The Constitution stands in his way. We have a decentralized election system in this country. Our elections are run at the state level. They're run at, you know, sometimes at the precinct level, you know, the county level. The federal government does not run our elections. They cannot simply step in and federalize our elections. So I say that, and I can hear some of your listeners saying, yeah, well, the Constitution says all sorts of things, and he's run roughshod over all of that. But, you know, in this case, things are very, very clear. That does not, however, mean that we shouldn't be concerned and alarmed and very vigilant, because certainly if you were looking to do a wholesale takeover of elections ahead of the midterms, you would be doing some of the things that they are talking about right now. So I think one of the most concerning fronts is what's underway right now in Georgia, where Trump is still attempting to prove that in 2020 the election was taken from him in Fulton County. The FBI, under the watchful eye of Tulsi Gabbard, went in and claimed all kinds of voting machines and tapes and ballots from 2020. The fear there is that this is the kind of move that the administration could take in swing states in order to try and stop a full and fair counting of ballots in important states, or that the presence of Gabbard suggests that Trump is looking for some legal fig leaf to proclaim a national emergency and to step in and federalize elections, or perhaps to find a way to force a state Republican takeover of this blue Fulton County, Atlanta election board. So lots of opportunity for mischief. You combine that with what's happening right now in Minnesota, the enforcement by ICE and immigration officials and in masks, really, you know, terrorizing a city. We've all watched the execution of American citizens protesting these activities. And what we have seen there, you know, is a city where citizens are afraid to go out to school, to work, to church, to buy groceries. And the question becomes, if people are that nervous to go about daily life under what has essentially been, you know, federal occupation, how will they feel on election day? What if what we are seeing in Minnesota is a dry run for the kinds of activities you might see in Atlanta, Detroit, Philadelphia, Milwaukee in October and November of this year? You have masked ICE officers intimidating citizens into staying home for fear that they will be asked for papers or, you know, find themselves on the other side of a very aggressive enforcement process.
Please describe the SAVE Act, the Safeguard American Voter Eligibility Act, in the House and Senate. I think there's two different versions, and there's a concern that Trump will urge Republicans in the Senate particularly to override the filibuster for this bill.
I don't think these senators will override the filibuster for this, but certainly if they did, it contains, you know, a lot of the, you know, election denialists' biggest goals as far as, you know, national voter ID, and it would be very, very rigorous, and that would you know, get in the way of, you know, tens of millions of Americans from casting ballots. There are 69 million married women in this country who have a license that does not have their official name on it. All of these people in these instances could conceivably be on the wrong side of voter ID laws on election day. Prohibition on mail ballots, you know, lots and lots of things in these bills that would be problems that would put additional barriers between American citizens and the ballot box.
David, what's the most important thing that people generally, the opposition Democratic Party, can do to safeguard the elections, given all these threats out there?
I think we have to be hyper-vigilant, hyper-aware. The states that can count ballots early should be doing everything they can to make sure that they are counting ballots early, because what the administration is going to attempt to do is what they've done in previous elections, right? They're going to say, well, on election night, Republicans were ahead, and then you counted all of these mail ballots and all of these absentee ballots, and then our leads shrunk. So whatever we can do in advance to counter that narrative in all of these states that ought to begin the process of counting early votes as early as they can. And if you can be a part of this, if you can get out, if you can volunteer, if you can help protect elections and count ballots and become part of this process, we need you this year more than ever.
That was David Daley, senior fellow with the group FairVote.org and author of Anti-Democratic: Inside the Far Right's 50-Year Plot to Control American Elections. Learn more about the Trump GOP threat to a free and fair 2026 midterm election by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WMBR in Cambridge, Massachusetts, WXDR in New Orleans, Louisiana, KCBP in Modesto, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.